session 311, two presentations on African-American Mormons. Paper one is African-American Elders of Boston, Q. Walker Lewis, Enoch L. Lewis, and President Joseph T. Ball, presented by Connell O'Donovan. He's been a genealogist for over 30 years and is a freelance historian of Mormonism. In 1994, he published a history of homosexuality in Mormonism, and in 2005, a biography of the early African-American Elder Q. Walker Lewis. He is currently working on a book called Strange Fire about William Smith and the ecclesiastical crisis he ignited in New England in the mid-1840s. Connell resides in Santa Cruz, California, and has worked at the University of California there for 14 years. So, Connell O'Donovan.
Which doc?
That's that one.
Africans?
Yep.
I'll fill in a little time with some personal experiences. I came from the Bay Area, living there for 34 years or so, and got fairly well acquainted with the three black Americans. Alan Cherry, who was serving his mission there in the early years, and Betty Stevenson, who was a Relief Society president of the Oakland Ninth Branch, was a very good friend, especially of my wife. They were worked in the Relief Society together. And also Eldridge Cleaver, who was baptized there in Oakland, and I had a chance to chat with him right after his baptism. And then I've also traveled quite a bit around the world and spent some time in Ghana, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, where I knew two or three of the mission presidents and temple presidents, and that's one of the reasons I went over there, so that I could visit with them before they came back home. And I was on my own much of the time and really enjoyed that African country. I've also traveled around South Africa quite a bit, and up to Victoria Falls and into Kenya. In 1992, where I was able to videotape, interview some of the early members of the church who, most of them were converted by the church in foreign countries in Europe. While they were going to school, one was an architect, others were medical, various things. And so it was very interesting to talk with them, and I have that on the nice filmed interviews that I had with those early African saints in Kenya. So I'm really interested in what's coming up here, and I think you've ready.
We're ready.
So LDS historians have long sought to uncover the origins and context of the priesthood and temple ban imposed on people of African descent until 30 years ago, when Spencer Kimball rescinded this racialist policy. People have questioned the ban, if the ban was policy or doctrine, whether it was based on a modern revelation, an interpretation of ancient or modern scripture, or something merely spawned from U.S. mores of the antebellum period. And lastly, historians queried whether Joseph Smith or Brigham Young instigated the ban, and when. In my regional studies of early Mormonism in Massachusetts, I've uncovered at least tentative answers to all these questions, as shown by the lives of three African-American elders who resided in Boston in the 1830s and 40s. In fact, I believe that as many as seven men of African descent may have held LDS priesthood prior to 1847. My list includes Black Pete, Elijah Abel, Joseph T. Ball, Walker Lewis, his son Enoch L. Lewis, William McCary, and either John or Isaac Van Meter. The Lewises and Joas T. Ball regularly participated in the Boston branch, and along with William McCary, influenced LDS practice the most with regards to the priesthood ban. And I start with the first of the three Bostonians to receive priesthood, Joseph T. Ball. His father, Joseph Ball, was born in Jamaica in 1760 and came to Boston about 1790. He may have been a slave in Boston originally, but he was certainly, he may have been a slave in Jamaica, but he was certainly a free man when he moved to Boston. Joseph Ball's father may have been a man named Jack Ball, an early black man who died in Boston in 1793. In 1796, Joseph Ball, Sr. became one of the 44 founders of the Boston African Society, a mutual aid society for helping poor blacks, especially widows and orphans. On the second Tuesday of every month, they held a charity lecture and used other fundraising means to assist those in need. Later, it was called the African Humane Society. 2 years after the founding of it, Joseph Ball married a white woman, Mary Montgomery Drew, in Boston. Mary was born in 1773 to Charles Drew and Rachel Badger. The Badgers were one of the old Boston families, while the Drews were only two generations in Massachusetts and had originally come from the Isle of Guernsey off the coast of France. Joseph and his wife, Mary, set up their household on the northwest end of Boston, or of Beacon Hill, on what was then called Butolph Street, and it's now called Irving Street at number 12. And number 12 is in the lower left-hand corner, the little door that goes down into the basement. Although this is a later building, but this is the location of where their house was. Their first child, Mary Montgomery Ball, was born there in 1800, and she died unmarried at the age of 29. Their next child was Joseph T. Ball himself, born on February 21st, 1804. Young Joseph then had three sisters, Lucy Montgomery Ball, Martha Violet Ball, and Hannah Burdine Ball. Here in the 1810 census, showing that... And it's not... we'll just skip that. Here in the 1810 census, showing the Boston, or the Joseph Ball family as nine blacks. Who the other five black people were is unknown. In 1819, one more child was born, a son named Thomas, but he soon died in infancy. Joseph Ball Sr., whatever his occupation was, seems to have been quite well off, so little Thomas was buried in an upscale Mount Auburn cemetery in Cambridge, in what would become the Ball family plot with a large obelisk dominating it. By 1820, young Joseph T. Ball must have been away from home apprenticing elsewhere in the coopering trade, for he is not shown in with the family in the 1820 census. As a cooper, Ball learned how to make wooden staved vessels, such as barrels, buckets, tubs, butter churns, wooden pipes, and other kinds of casks. In 1829, as noted earlier, Joseph's older sister died in Boston, and she was buried in the Mount Auburn plot. In 1834, Joseph's younger sister, Lucy Montgomery Ball, began teaching at the infant school on Theater Alley. And around this time, Lucy and her sister, Martha Violet Ball, became integral members of the Boston Anti-Slavery Society and early cultural feminists. They began meeting with the likes of William Lloyd Garrison, the Grimke sisters, and the Weston sisters of Boston. Another fellow abolitionist whom they knew quite well was Frances Mary Smith. Miss Smith may have been how the family was actually introduced to Mormonism, for she was baptized in Boston on August 14, 1835, by Brigham Young. Also baptized by Brigham that day was Ruth Daggett Vose, who would later become a plural wife of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo. Although I have no evidence that the Ball sisters joined the LDS Church, I do know that a year after Frances Mary Smith, the other abolitionist, after she was baptized, their older brother, Joseph T. Ball, converted to Mormonism in the summer of 1836. He was likely baptized by either Brigham Young or his brother Joseph, who were the two main missionaries in Boston in August 1836. The Ball House at 12 Butolph Street then became a center for Boston missionaries and apostles to stop in for food and shelter for almost the next decade. During the first year after Ball's conversion, all these visiting church representatives would have been well acquainted with his Jamaican-born father, Joseph Sr. So even though the Ball children were apparently quite light-complexioned, LDS visitors would have known of their African heritage and ancestry. A year after Ball's baptism, Joseph Ball Sr. died at the age of 67, and he too was buried at Mount Auburn. We can assume that Joseph T. Ball was ordained an elder by December 1837, for he left on his first of many missions on the second week of January 1838. He was called to be Wilford Woodruff's companion in Maine, and they would end up serving several missions together over the years. And for the next 3 years, we have almost a daily chronicle of Elder Ball's activities, because Wilford Woodruff, his companion, kept extensive journals. Woodruff's entry for January 13 records, "From the mainland of Maine, I crossed to the North Haven Island to visit the saints and also an elder of the Church of Latter-day Saints." Who had come to labor with me in the ministry by the name of Joseph Ball. I visited Brother Sterrett, walked from thence to Brother James, and there I found Elder Ball. I had a pleasant interview with him. He had already baptized 6 persons by the time I had arrived. Elders Woodruff and Ball were very successful in their missions to the islands off the coast of Maine and baptized many people from January 1838 and throughout 1839. Their efforts were very successful, and I was going to show an article from the Vermont Chronicle that complained about how successful they were, that there were no more good Christians left in Vinyl Haven. They had all abandoned it for Mormonism. Ball and Woodruff returned periodically to Boston, although they also proselyted in the interior of Massachusetts as well as in Rhode Island, New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York, sometimes paired or sometimes alone. When elders Ball and Woodruff were on their missions, Ball's 2 sisters, Martha and Lucy, were making a stir in the abolitionist movement as women of African descent in the mostly white movement. They were friends with Garrison, Frederick Douglass, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, the Grimke sisters, and other notable abolitionists, and including several in England with whom they frequently corresponded. By 1838, Martha Ball was serving as the recording secretary of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, and Lucy was its treasurer. Martha was especially honored by being selected as one of only 2 black delegates to the Boston Society's National Conference in Philadelphia, where she was also elected to be the secretary of the convention. Unfortunately, legal authorities in Philadelphia instigated a mob that descended on the convention that year. They threw stones through the windows of Pennsylvania Hall, blocked the doors, and threatened the delegates as they walked to and from their lodgings. After the first night of the convention, the mob actually burned the hall down because it had housed, quote, "an audience promiscuously mixed up of blacks and whites, sitting together in amalgamated ease." Within a year, though, the 2 Ball sisters would cause even more controversy within the abolitionist movement. As women found new voices and choices in their new landscape of social and political influence, they began to question where their moral authority came from, what drove them to end slavery and other social ills, including the degradation of women. In Boston, the Weston sisters, Deborah, Anne, and Maria, began divorcing their moral authority from Protestant Christianity. And alarmed at this seemingly anti-religious trend in the movement, the Ball sisters, who remained staunchly Christian throughout their lives, abandoned the Boston Anti-Slavery Society, causing a huge division in the movement. And they formed their own competing organization, the Boston Female Emancipation Society, while the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society dissolved into dissension. In December of 39, Woodruff found Elder Ball in Manhattan, where Ball was working with Parley P. Pratt. On the 12th of December, Woodruff mysteriously records in his journal, quote, "I attended a conference at Parley's in the case of Elder Joseph Ball, as a number of accusations were brought against him," but there's no record of what those accusations were. 1840 found Elder Ball in Connecticut, and later in March he was in the companion of Elder Truman Gillette in Iowa, where he baptized the John Leica family, who later became very prominent in the reorganized LDS Church. He was then released from his mission and returned to Boston in April 1840. On May 1st, he was then sent on another mission, this one just to the surrounding areas. He went, and he was very successful in baptizing over 150 people. In the meantime, Woodruff visited Boston and stayed with Joseph's widowed mother, Mary Drew Ball, at her home on Butoff Street. On August 16, 1841, Elder Joseph Ball was first appointed to go on a mission to South America. 2 weeks later, the Quorum of the 12 held a council at Brigham Young's home in Nauvoo and resolved, quote, to send Joseph Ball to South America and Elder Harrison Sayers to Jamaica. The two elders were commanded to accompany each other as far as New Orleans, where they would then part ways, but then for unknown reasons they failed to comply. So the Quorum of the 12 met again in October of 1841, and again called the two men to South America and Jamaica. Yet again, neither man did as directed. Ball did continue to proselyte, but he was in Iowa. He returned to Boston area in 1842, and by the end of 43, he was back in Ohio proselyting. Although Ball had had those mysterious difficulties in New York, as Woodward noted, Elder Ball's fate took a turn for the worse in December 1843. Samuel Brannan arrived at Clinton County, Ohio, only to have, quote, the happy fortune of meeting with Elder Ball, who was lifting up a warning voice to the inhabitants of that region, end of quote. Brannan was, as it turned out, one of William Smith's inner circle of trusted elders who were pushing Mormon boundaries and dancing on the edge of apostasy. William Smith, George J. Adams, Thomas A. Lyon, and Samuel Brannan were hard-drinking elders whose fantasies of grandeur overemphasized their own importance in Mormonism and overstepped their authority, especially when it came to the young women of New England. With William Smith, an apostle, and George J. Adams as a member of the Council of the 50, they were well aware of Joseph Smith's secret practice of polygamy and took advantage of this by putting into practice their own form of polygamy, which they called spiritual wifery. William even audaciously gave Samuel Brannan sealing authority, as these men traveled on their missions throughout New England and elsewhere in 43 and 44, they sealed themselves to various women throughout New England. Unsuspecting Mormons in the local branches viewed these actions with horror, disbelief, and generous amounts of misunderstanding. Those Mormons who happened to be aware of Joseph Smith's own practice of polygamy looked the other way and let the circle of elders make their way across New England. Those who knew only the public denials of polygamy were understandably very angry and believed that William Smith and his cohorts were the worst kind of sinners. After Joseph Smith's death in June 1844, William Smith radically stepped up his deviant behaviors to the detriment of the church in the East, and the branches began to implode. Such was the case especially in Boston, where a small number of leading men were aware of polygamy, but the vast majority of members and leaders had no idea that it was being both taught and practiced. With William Smith, George J. Adams, Sam Brannan, and Thomas A. Lyon carousing through the branches, sealing each other to young women, and then abandoning them, the stage was set for disaster in the church. Having been Brannan's companion for a time in Ohio, Elder Ball, now back in his hometown of Boston, was drawn into William Smith's inner circle by the fall of 1844 and was receiving secret doctrines from these men that were not exactly in line even with what Joseph Smith had intended. The person most deeply affected by the imploding Boston branch was its branch president, John Hardy, who had converted in 1842 and then had been made the branch president in February of 43. And under his leadership, the branch had really flourished. Around the middle of 44, Elder Hardy, who had heard rumors of the more controversial doctrinal innovations that William Smith and company were introducing, made some quiet inquiries among branch members, and discovering that indeed Smith and his circle were engaged in sexual practices that made most Christians blush, Hardy quietly requested to be released from the presidency of the Boston branch. And under William Smith's direction, his resignation was accepted, and Smith's own protege, Elder Joseph T. Ball, was installed as his replacement of the Boston branch president. Wilford Woodruff, who happened to be passing through Boston at that time, noted in his journal, quote, the first business that day that was done after I arrived was Elder John Hardy resigned his office as presiding elder and Joseph Ball appointed in his stead. The appointment of Elder Ball was opposed by Elder Phelps, but Phelps was soon borne down by Sam Brannan and William Smith. I saw things were wrong somewhere. And then 2 days later, he wrote to Brigham Young, quote, I will confess that some feeling came across me that made me squirm all over when I saw their wrong spirits and conflicting spirits. Elder Phelps was the only man that openly opposed Elder Ball's appointment. I soon discovered from various sources that the conduct of William Smith, Adams, Brannan, Ball, etc., had been such in crowding their spiritual wife claims, visiting the churches, uniting together in begging money, running all over the rites of presiding elders, on the claim that William was one of the 12 and the prophet's brother. Adams, Smith, and Brannan was combining with the press to do anything to carry out their designs. Elder Ball has taught, as well as William Smith, the girls that it is not wrong to have intercourse with the men what they please, and Elder Ball tries to sleep with them whenever he can. End of quote. Despite these troubling activities, Apostle Woodruff did nothing to stop them. He merely continued to file his grievances in his reports to Brigham Young because he had actually been called on a mission to England, and he felt that while he was there in Boston, he had no jurisdiction there.
3 minutes.
Oh, my goodness, 3 minutes. Well, and how much time were you giving me? Because I should have about 25 minutes.
Well, that's if we would have started those.
Yeah,
times.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So 20 he, minutes.
Eventually, Elder Ball was released as the branch president, and Hartley P. Pratt sent him to Nauvoo to work on the temple and to receive his endowments. He did arrive in Nauvoo. He received his patriarchal blessing from the new patriarch, William Smith, in which William Smith confirmed that he had earlier ordained Joseph Ball as a high priest in the Melchizedek priesthood. And then, so, which I think makes Joseph Ball the first African-American high priest in the Mormon church, as well as having been the first presiding elder over an LDS congregation. Really quickly, the other two African-American elders that I wanted to talk about were Elder Walker Lewis and his son Enoch Lewis. They had Walker Lewis was named for his uncle, who, as a slave, had sued his own master for his freedom in 1781, and by 1783 it went to the Massachusetts State Supreme Court, and they ruled in favor of Walker Lewis's uncle and emancipated him, and by doing so actually emancipated all slaves in Massachusetts. And so with that abolitionist background, Walker Lewis and his family were radical abolitionists in Boston and in the Lowell, Massachusetts areas. Walker Lewis was also, besides being a radical abolitionist and very much involved in, he also became president of the African Humane Society that Joseph Ball had founded in 1796. But he was also a master mason and actually became the most worshipful grand master of African Lodge No. 1, which made him the highest presiding black Freemason in the entire world. And he was also a much higher ranking mason than any other Mormon would ever become. Let's see. He joined the church probably about 1841-42. He was ordained an elder in summer of 1843 by William Smith. His home became a place for meetings. The elders passed through there. He was very generous with his money and gave them gifts and held the church meetings there in his home. In the mid-1840s, however, there was controversy brewing. His son, who also appeared to have been ordained an elder by William Smith, Enoch Lovejoy Lewis, Enoch married a white woman, a white Mormon woman named Mary Matilda Webster. And then they had a baby, also called Enoch Lovejoy Lewis Jr. And William I. Appleby, who was a missionary passing through there, discovered that this black elder had married a white Mormon woman. And he not only wrote a report to Brigham Young, but then he also showed up at winter quarters in December of 1847 to directly report to the Quorum of the Twelve that this, what he thought was a horrendous event, had taken place. And Brigham Young was also horrified by the fact that a black elder had married a white member of the church. And they...
It's time to quit. Okay.
I'm segueing into Patrick's paper. There was on December 3rd, 1847, there was a very important Quorum of the Twelve meeting in which Brigham Young stated that he made some really awful statements about mulattoes are like mules and are unable to reproduce and they shouldn't have any children. They should be denied the priesthood. And then one of his statements was that even the Potawatomi Indians would not, quote unquote, own a Negro man, and that was the reason that they had disowned the Negro prophet. And that is a reference to William McCary, who was an African-American elder in Winter Quarters at that time. And with that, we'll move on.
Yeah, good. Patrick Polk is our next presenter, a PhD folklorist, focuses on religion, visual traditions, popular culture, with the context of the African diaspora. Author of several books with another, Conjurers, Healers, and Hoodoo Doctors, readings on African American magic and folk medicine forthcoming. And I also found out that he has a Mormon ancestor from Kirtland, but that's seven generations ago. So he still has a little bit of connection, even though it's a long time.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be here today. I'm going to read a little bit and go through the slides, and hopefully at the end we'll get a chance after Newell's commentary, and maybe also to have Connell have a chance to talk a little more about the Walker family. So basically, well, 30 years after the watershed revelation that lifted the ban on black priesthood in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, academic and avocational researchers alike continue working tirelessly to recognize and recover the black presence in Mormon history. The primary subject of my presentation today, William McCary, is remembered as an enigmatic troublemaker who may well have played a crucial role in the establishment of the priesthood ban. My primary intent here is to introduce new information gathered from archival records and other untapped data sources that shed additional light on the life, or at least current understandings, of McCary. In addition to broadening our understanding of this individual, I address... I address the broader issue of race, blackness, and the slippage, the difficulties we often find in applying rigid categories of racial designation, and then the realities of human, social, ritual, cultural activity, and family making, and so on. And so what I call the enigma of William McCary is firmly embedded in this, and so that we need to recognize the flexibility of American racial categorization to understand, or at least to begin to understand, what McCary means to, certainly to Mormon history, and what he represents in, again, in broader American history. So what I want to do is go through some slides primarily, and I'll just talk a little bit, a couple of things prefacing, then getting into the fuller story of William McCary in the Mormon Church. And so I use the term magic mulatto in a very, well, what ultimately is a tragic sense. I mean, the term tragic mulatto may be familiar to people, which again is a paradigm in American, certainly in American literature, American dramatic history, American social history in general, of the person who's neither nor. The individual who, by nature of their racial heritage, puts them in what frequently is a tragic circumstance, in that neither black, neither white. So what class, what caste, what race are you? And so that this whole circumstance of people who are truly cast out, often in many senses, and it becomes a real metaphor for human tragedy. And so the flip side of that also, and this is really where what I want to get at with certainly understanding William McCary in the church, is the flip side of the tragic mulatto is what you might call the magic mulatto. Because by that same instance of sort of structural social indefinability lets you also play with that play with the institutions, if you understand what I'm saying. In other words, if I'm neither black nor I'm neither white, or if I'm some less categorized racial social identity, well, how can I use that to my own benefit? If people aren't sure who or what I am, well, maybe I can provide answers for them that are that can certainly be personally beneficial. And so this is what I'm why my Magic Mulatto. And you know, and I'll give a couple examples here, but if we just think about William McCary in Mormon history, and again, I wish it was a little darker in here, but can you see the, you can see the red and the white? Okay. I mean, who was William McCary? I mean, is he a prophet? Was he a troublemaker? I guess you can be a prophet and a troublemaker at once. You know, was he a Lamanite, Negro, son of Ham, half Indian? Brigham Young seems to suggest he was a useful man. Brigham Young perhaps suggested he was a scoundrel as well, and that again might not be mutually exclusive. But again, here's a man who is a big question mark, and he's absolutely a question mark in Mormon history. And as Newell has absolutely demonstrated in his work, he's like, you know, where did he come from? Where did he go? And so that's what I want to get at today is to elucidate a bit of that history. A couple examples of just talking about the Magic Mulatto. Pascal Beverly Randolph, born 1825, died 1875, is sort of a classic example of that, in that he was an abolitionist activist. He was an activist for women's rights early on. He was also a spiritualist, a trance medium for several decades. Also, arguably the founder of the American Rosicrucian Order. And he was a serious question mark for a lot of people. His racial heritage was mixed race. By our best documentation, his mother was African American. His father was either mulatto or Anglo. But throughout his entire career, he played with that magic mulatto-ness in the sense that he often presented himself as descendant from Native Americans, or in the closest to Africa he often got was to say he was descended, his mother was descended from a queen of Madagascar. But to this day, certainly within Rosicrucian society, there's an ongoing argument of what his race was. And a number of people absolutely insist that he was white. Other folks absolutely insist that he was African American, and it exemplifies this situation. If there are any fans here of 1950s television, maybe you had to live in Los Angeles. But has anybody ever heard of Corla Pandit? No, not much anymore. Corla Pandit was an early musician on television. He played exotica music, and he was, by some accounts, the first East Indian to become popular on American television. Except for the truth is, he's actually the first African-American to have had a television program in the United States. And the only real distinction was he put a turban on his head and changed his name. And by that simple magical act, he went from African-American, born in Oklahoma, to a East Indian from the Orient, who went on also as a career as a guru and a New Age kind of, prophet in Los Angeles. Now, I say Mormon country. I want to mention quickly again one person who would be more familiar to Utah history, which would be James Beckwith, who, again, presents an interesting kind of paradigm. According to most narratives, his father was a white Virginian. His mother was a slave. He was eventually went on to become an army scout, a trapper, a western explorer. They certainly, folks place him in what became Utah in the 1820s, moving back and forth from California to the Midwest as a real trailblazer. Now, as part of a life history that was published in 1856, he proclaimed, among other things, to have, at one instance, to have been the stolen child of a Native American chief, and that this was part of an entry point into adopting a Native American identity, and according to his story, spending a number of years as a Native American war chief. He's also a trapper, and according to sort of the lore, the tradition of that, some folks just said he was a gaudy liar, that he was just making this story up. But again, he fits the paradigm. When people put lies of race upon you, well, perhaps the most appropriate response is to use that lie to your advantage. But at any rate, he became certainly famous, and today he's a hallmark of early African-American Western history. But he certainly, in his lifetime, used the discourse of the magic mulatto, and it was used on him. And so just again, before I get to William McCary, if you actually look from 1850s images, all of which presumed to represent Beckworth, you see funny things. In the middle image, for all intents and purposes, he's white. And in fact, many of the early narratives about him presented him as white, that he was simply an Anglo explorer, like Kit Carson and others with whom he kept company. In other instances, they sort of suggested a darkness to him, which might have been Native American or so, by sort of shading his face and hands to appropriate color level. If we look at one of the earliest daguerreotypes of him, by today's standards, I can't imagine anybody would read him as anything other than African-American. But again, it's this idea of racial categories in the slippage and how one can find a way through life by doing so, or at least by utilizing and manipulating that. Which brings us to, in the last few minutes here, to William McCary. Where's the best place to?
I have about 2 minutes.
Oh well, that's actually perfect. In fact, I'll just do this. If I read this, Okeechobee, which is the name by which William McCary is best known today, Okeechobee was born Warner McCary in 1910 in Natchez, Mississippi. According to birth records, the records of his early life in Natchez, he was the enslaved son of an African-American woman and presumably her Pennsylvania-born white master. Early on, his father passed away, his presumed father passed away when he was under 10 years old. His older enslaved sister were both manumitted in the will of the deceased father. Of the three children, only Warner was to remain a slave. So in his own family life, by all appearances, he became the slave to his formerly enslaved family members. So early on there's a question about what was going on in this family. In early adulthood, Warner became among other things, he was a barber, a blacksmith. He was a master musician. He served as a militia fifer for militias up and down the Mississippi River. And as he became older, he went through a series of, again, perfectly attuned to the concept of magic mulatto, of names and identities. So the narrative by which we know him as Okeechobee was published in 1848 first, and his story, rather similar to that of, and I'm sure not by accident, of James Beckwith, presents him rather, instead of as an African-American slave, he tells the story that he was the abducted child of a Native American chief who had been stolen and sold into slavery. And through his life, he went, in terms of many names, Warner McCary, William McCary, who William McCary and William Chubby are what he became known to in Mormon camp. And he came into connection with Mormons from 1845 to 1848, roughly, marrying into a white Mormon family of highest standing. He married Lucy Celesta Stanton, daughter of Daniel Stanton, who was first stake president of the Quincy Stake, who was certainly an electman of Zion, again of the highest order. And so during a brief time of 2 years, Warner, William, Oka, Julius, and so on. I'm getting the signal. We're out of here. Fine. Married into Mormon church, into the Mormon society, presented himself as a prophet, and then moved on. I'm going to take one minute, just because I want to show one thing here, beyond the fact that this is a man of multi-talents, living in a world which, based on apparent color, could put you into multi-categories. And one last thing is I would urge anybody to go get the sketch of the life of Okeechobee and compare how he writes about his Native American experience to some of the key elements of the Mormon doctrine, Mormon church history, in that Oka, in many ways, presented himself as a prophet, and one could argue a counter-prophet at a time of many counter-prophets in the Mormon church. And at the very least, in his continual reworking and rewriting of his life, integrated a number of these elements into his story. All right, well, that's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our respondent is Noah Bringhurst.
I feel really bad that this session had to be truncated the way that it was, because we were 15-20 minutes into getting started, as you're well aware, and so the presentations they gave just doesn't do justice to the extensive path-breaking research that these two gentlemen have done, and I just want to make that point very clear, because they've brought forth a whole bunch of important new information and new insights. In some respects, what they have come up with confirms and reinforces some of the conclusions that I made in my initial study on blacks, saints, slaves, and blacks. I have the book right there. You want to hold that up? Yeah, the bottom one. Yeah, back in 1981. But yet, at the same time, they have brought forth new information that really, what I think really the bottom line is, that it really underscores how important and what a critical role that African Americans played in the early LDS church. And, a lot of that history, was subsequently lost, strayed, and deliberately suppressed, both deliberately and indeliberately, forgotten, conveniently forgotten, particularly in the wake of the implementation of black priesthood denial. In fact, the extensive activities and involvement of these individuals, and I found the information on Joseph Ball in particular, I was not that aware of that prior to receiving his presentation here, that Joseph Ball was such a seminal figure. In many ways, his activities were comparable to those of William McCary, whose activities and role Patrick has done a fantastic job of uncovering, and of Walker Lewis and his son Enoch. Their various activities. You can see why Brigham Young, when he implemented black priesthood denial, when he moved toward the implementation of black priesthood denial in beginning in 1847, and publicly affirmed in 1852, was clearly thinking of the various activities of all of these individuals and how they had impacted. Because as their papers point out, these Mormon leaders, these Mormon apostles, had direct interaction and contact with these various African Americans, and I really hope that their works, I'm hoping to see that their works get published and the recognition given thereof. That's all that I'm going to say. Do we have any time for questions at all, or are we completely out of time? Do we have a minute or so?
1 minute.
1 minute. Somebody run a race up there and go ahead.
Given the early activities of this small community in the early church, you would square the long-term racist denial of the priesthood directly on the shoulders of Brigham Young?
Brigham Young was the primary instigator of it, but other high Mormon leaders also played a role in that. But Brigham Young, because he became the leader of the majority of Latter-day Saints following the death of Joseph Smith. He was the prime. I see him as the primary instigator. I do indeed. I think that people like Orson Hyde, Orson Pratt, others had input with the doctrines and ideas that they brought forth. Certainly played a role in that, but Brigham Young, I really put it primarily on his shoulders, no question about it. I don't know how the rest of you feel about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the reality is, like, looking at the history of McCary's time in the Mormon camp, it's absolute that on one hand there's...
You want to come up here and speak? Go ahead, Patrick. Go ahead. You need to speak to the microphone.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a suggestion that Brigham understood, and McCary presented himself as a counter-prophet. And so there certainly was a tension within there in terms of just who actually is a revelator. And so, and McCary certainly, as a result of his actions, had the Stanton family were essentially excommunicated for apostasy. Most all of them, except for Lucy, were returned to the church. And even more so, in certainly for the next 20 years at different points, I know that Brigham had personal interactions with Stanton's family. So, in fact, he presided over the wedding of one of the daughters who was of Lucy. And so it's certainly, at the very least, kind of a thorn in the lion's paw, if you will.
I'd like to thank all of those who participated.
That is the most appropriate ending I've ever had.